appropriation. We have a number of people invited this morning for invited testimony. Also, we have an open public hearing for anyone else that would wish to testify. We have some procedural items to take care of at the beginning of this meeting, which we will take care of fairly promptly, and we will get right into public testimony. I would indicate at this time, and my co-chair here, Representative Flores, I believe will agree with this statement, what we want to hear from people this morning is largely what they believe should be in this ballot measure one statement in terms of what they believe the committee's work should be, what they believe the conclusion should be that we come to. And at this particular point, we will take this testimony, go back, write a draft statement, and we will hopefully have time to circulate that so that people will have a chance to respond. We will start off this morning by an adoption of committee rules. The committee rules are pretty standard for a committee. If people have had a chance to quickly peruse them, they're on your desk. I move adoption of the rules. Senator Starr has moved adoption. Is there any discussion? Is there any dissent? Motion passes. Now we'll go through introductions, and I guess I'll start at my... It's not mentioning anything about political persuasion. I'll start at my far left.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Brad Avakian, state rep from Washington County. And actually, I'm just kind of carpetbagging today, but I'm not really a member of the committee, but obviously I have an interest in public education. I wanted to sit in, so thank you to both co-chairs for allowing me to.
I'm Susan Morgan, a state rep from Southern Douglas County, and I'm taking exception to being on the left of Devlin.
I'm Chuck Riley, representative from Central Washington County, and I'm happy to be part of this. Thank you.
I'm Representative Linda Flores, and I represent House District 51, which is Clackamas, Damascus, Boren, Estacada, and chair of the House Interim Committee on Education.
Oh, Jim Keller, I'm your committee administrator.
I'm Richard Devlin. I'm senator, co-chair of this committee, and very pleased to serve on this committee. It's actually my first time. I believe it's Representative Morgan's third time on this committee. So she probably has more background than anyone else in terms of this committee's work. I'll leave it at that and go to my good friend, Senator Starr.
Senator Charles Starr, representing District 13, parts of four counties, from Sherwood to Kaiser. This is my second time on this committee, and served as Vice Chair of Education in the Senate during the last session.
And our final committee member, who's not here at this time, is Senator Walker, who we were still anticipating will arrive sometime this morning. Can we actually, I need about 15 seconds to talk to the co-chair, and then we'll start the rest of the meeting. We will go ahead and begin the testimony. We would ask people to limit their testimony to about 5 to 7 or 8 minutes. We would ask the committee to withhold their questions until after each person has testified. Not all people testifying and then questions, but after each person so that we don't interrupt people that are testifying. I believe Ms. Massey is here somewhere who has to. Please come forward. And if you would identify yourself for the record and your position, and please present your testimony.
Good morning. I am Susan Massey. And my position is acting chair of the Quality Education Commission. And it's a pleasure to be able to visit with you this morning about my views on this work. I believe that down through quite a bit of history, there was just sort of a relationship of trust about what education costs and what we should be spending. And then we became more sophisticated and we started talking more about things like accountability. And we believed we really needed to know for sure and be able to document the cost of education. And so that's when the Quality Education Commission was formed. There was concurrence on a goal to get 90% of Oregon students up to standard by the year 2014. And we began. The charge of the commission was to determine the amount of money sufficient to ensure that the state system of K-12 public education meets the quality goals established in statute. The Constitution also sets out a role for the legislature. It establishes that the legislative assembly shall appropriate in each biennium a sum of money sufficient to ensure that the state system of public education meets the quality goals established by the law. And so you see, we were established as a team, the commission setting the cost, the legislative body funding the work. And it seems to me that in later times, we haven't always worked as a team, but I believe we are a team. We are established as a team, and things will work best when we see it that way. But you say, what are the reasons for that high number, that eye-popping number the commission comes out with when they do their analysis every time? And so I'd like to talk to you about some of the reasons I believe that number is high. There are just a few things that we can do to improve our ability to get kids up to standard. There aren't really magic bullets. There are things that we've always known made the difference. One of those things is time on task. And as you know, in Oregon now, time on task has been eroding, and yet the original vision was to increase time on task so that we could assure that kids reached high standards. We know that we need quality teachers and administrators, and we know that we need extra support for people who find learning difficult for whatever reason. Those are the things that are contained in the quality education model that bring the number up. There are some other reasons why educating our students these days is more expensive than it was when you and I went to school. One is the flow of immigrants, and we're all aware of that situation. One is an increase, I believe, in special needs students, and of course the mandates from the federal level on how we will deal with those special needs. And another is poverty, and increasing poverty in these times. And it is has been documented over and over that children growing up in poverty need extra support as they come along. The gap between what the commission recommends and what we are spending is growing. I believe it exceeds $1 billion now. And while I'm here to acknowledge that I know we probably can't just step up to the plate and fund that gap all in one big jump, I think that we certainly do need to be making plans, not only just to look at the numbers, but to look at how we can truly bring our students up to the high standards that we've set for them in the system.
Questions for Ms. Massey? Any questions on that? I do have one question. Yes, Representative Morgan.
Mrs. Massey, first of all, thank you for coming all the way up here. I know this is a rather long commute for you, and I appreciate you giving us your time today. The given that the number that the Quality Education Commission puts forward, it being so much larger than what the legislature is able to put into the school fund, does the Quality Education Commission ever get into discussions about how to bring the standards up without coming to the recommended number that the commission puts out? I mean, are there things that we can do in the commission's opinion that won't to spend the money differently or to do things differently that will enhance the quality of education that the students receive?
That's a great question. I think it's the can we do more with less question. And of course, as we do have local control, as we do have individual districts making decisions, I believe that efficiencies are higher in some districts than others. But yes, we do. And I can tell you that our agenda for this coming cycle includes a look at the system to see how we can be more directive to get that money where it will make the most difference, the money that we have now. We're always looking at that. And yet there comes a point at which you just can't make the soup thinner. And whether we're there yet or not could be debated, but I believe we're in danger of being there. We have three or four agenda items that you might like to know about. One is to simply update the model. Every cycle we put in current numbers instead of the old numbers to account for inflation and other things that may have changed. This year we're also looking at ways we might reconfigure that model to make it more transparent, to make it easier to understand. We also do plan to look for efficiencies. We plan to work some with providing a spending history. How much money were we spending 10 years ago versus how much are we spending now, so that we might speak, the commission might speak with authority about the record of spending in Oregon. And then one of the biggest things that we want to do is talk about all of this, to communicate, not to just keep it among us folks the way we do now, it seems, in spite of our best efforts. But we'd really like to find a way to get the message out across the state to the public, and others about what's going on.
Mr. Co-Chair, might I have a follow-up
Yes.
question? I'm wondering also if the commission, through the department, has done any work in comparing the recommended spending categories and the amounts that are recommended to be spent in the different categories with what individual school districts are actually doing. I think one of the things that is a little hard to work with the quality education model is that it reflects what I call the Brigadoon school district. It isn't real on the ground applicable information. And given the diversity of situations that educators find themselves in different areas of the state, I'm wondering what the quality of the conversation is with the different district superintendents about how their individual district is comparing with the way that the quality education model feels that resources should be distributed.
It is true that the model isn't based on a specific school district. It is more or less an average. However, as superintendents look at it, they do look at it in terms of percentages. What percent are we spending for certified staff? What percent are we spending for transportation? That helps considerably. I know a few school districts have even made the quality education model the model for their budgets, and they are directly applying on a percentage basis those numbers. It is a guideline to make it prescriptive and say you have to spend such and such percent on this category would be too difficult in light of the diversity that you mentioned. But it is a guideline.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I? Thank you.
Representative Morgan, were you?
I'm finished.
Oh, I'm
thank
sorry.
You.
Representative Lofkin.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I am, before I ask you, or I guess give you my statement, I'd want to mention that in the musical, Brigadoon was a real place, that the characters did almost anything they could do to get to and stay at. But one of my favorite musicals, by the way. I'm glad to hear that you're going to do an analysis of spending. And I would hope that when you do that analysis that you include a few factors that oftentimes are overlooked. One of those is that in the last 10 to 15 years, there's been a tremendous increase in the amount of fees that parents pay for their children to participate in what used to be a free public education system. And those numbers ought to be added into the current cost of education. So should the $350 to $500 per year that teachers pay out of their own paychecks in order to buy things like papers and crayons for their kids. That should be considered a cost of public education. And the other is the incredible increase in volunteer hours that parents and other people in the community put in order to accomplish things that used to be accomplished by paid staff. All of those things are costs that aren't reflected in what we pay out of our general fund, mm-hmm. but that are necessary in order for schools to provide what they provide. So I would include those three things and anything else that your committee could find that is an added cost to public education today.
Thank you. I appreciate that reminder. I will take note of that.
Senator Stone.
Thank you. I, too, appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. My concern is that we are looking at a model that may no longer exist in the future. I think that with the changes in our the way children are educated and the possibilities of virtual education, that building these huge schools that we are today continues to lock us into a model that's unfundable. And I say it's unfundable because cost drivers that we are unable to control are growing so rapidly. And that's retirement benefit costs and the health care costs that are just eating us up. My sense is that looking at a quality education should be looked at from the standpoint of outcomes for children, and not based on what has been the long-term model. I just feel strongly that we're going to see a huge shift in the way children get an education. And if we don't visualize that and work on that early, we're going to be in much more serious trouble in 10 years than we are today.
I think you make some very good points, Senator, and certainly there are high costs, high support costs. However, I would ask you to remember that those high public costs of health benefits and retirement are not confined solely to the education sector.
Agreed.
We also have issues in public safety, and yet we don't talk about the fact that we don't need policemen anymore or firemen. and so I think that's one to keep in mind, and you're absolutely right about the fact that delivery systems may change. As delivery systems change, then we also need to change with them. There is some study that shows that even if you change delivery systems, you need considerable personal support with that in order to provide a healthy, wholesome education. I believe there will always be a need for human interaction, whether we're young or not so young. But it is something certainly to bear in mind. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you, Mrs. Massey. A couple of questions primarily about the original vision that the Quality Education Commission brought forward with the Quality Education Model. Now, by virtue of its title, Model, would it be safe to assume or could you affirm that this is a model, a tool, an implement for exercise as distinguished from a mandated level of funding?
Yes, absolutely. And yet it is a model constructed on what we believe are the elements of a quality education.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And in that regard, as far as the elements of a quality education, have you taken expansive look at the research, best practices, and so on from numerous fields of study and so on?
Yes, we have. In fact, over the past several cycles, we've had a best practices panel, which has attempted to find all the latest research on what really works and what doesn't. And we have some things called quality indicators that we believe are more specific elements of what it takes to make a child successful in this system that we would like to develop more, but whether or not they are developed as they certainly are elements we know work. Mm-hmm. Things like parental involvement, things like that, that are harder to measure, but we know they're very important.
Another follow-up, yes. Mr. Co-Chair, thank you. And thank you. I'm just kind of liking to have this dialogue here just so we can kind of get some of the groundwork set here. Now, was the model crafted and created at a time when we had currently in place some benchmarks for Oregon education, or did the benchmarks come along after?
It's my understanding that the commission was created in 1999. I wasn't a member at that time, but the benchmarks, of course, were laid out in the early 90s. So I think the benchmarks were first. The standards were first.
Follow up?
Yes.
And in that same line then, was there consideration given, or has there been consideration given by the commission in regard to some of the requirements of the federal No Child Left Behind?
We are keenly aware of the existence of No Child Left Behind. The state of Oregon was forward-looking enough in 1999 to set a goal of bringing 90% of students up to standards. And, of course, you may or may not know that No Child Left Behind asks for 99 or 100%. And we have not quantified how much more we believe it would take to bring all children up to standards, because we aren't sure what it would take to bring that last 10%. What would the programs need to look like? I did mention earlier some things that make a difference in general, but when you're talking about the last 10%, you're talking about the students who are the very hardest to educate, and that's going to take some work that we haven't up until now been able to do.
Thank you.
Senator Walker, then Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Nice to join you all. Sorry I was delayed. I was at the gym this morning and couldn't get off that Stairmaster, trying to lose those Christmas calories. Ms. Massey, I just had to chuckle when Representative Avakian asked you to consider the three areas that had not previously been considered. I appreciate that he wants you to do that. But you already testified that we're about $1 billion out of whack between the model and what we're doing. And I suspect when you add Representative Avakian's three areas in there, we're going to be about $2 billion out of whack. Yeah. So my question was, you did talk about needing to communicate, which was one of the areas that you're looking at now, and I couldn't agree with you more. Most people don't even know where all of the money goes in the state mm-hmm. budget.
And exactly.
That's the thing, is to educate them where the money goes, how it's spent. Mm-hmm. And in that regard, has the Quality Education Commission worked with the Chalkboard Project at all? Because they have gone out across the state in great numbers, and I don't know if you have partnered with them to help make that communication better or not.
I personally did have a wonderful conversation with Sue Hildick about just such a partnership, and especially in the area of communication. It was early then. They were just forming their plan about what to take out and how to take it out to the public. And we haven't talked lately, but we do have a number of people on the commission, on our staff, who are working directly with the Chalkboard. I believe this is a natural partnership, and mm-hmm. we would like to maximize it to the extent possible.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Kocher. Mrs. Massey, you mentioned that there were districts that did budget on a structure that parallels the quality education mm-hmm. model. Are there very many districts that do that?
I wish I could answer your question. I don't know. I know that one of them was Gresham, and I believe West Lynn was going to take up something like that. But, no, I'm not aware in specific details.
The question that I had was, I was curious if there was any tracking done on those districts that do fund in conformance with the model as to what their attainments are for the students against the benchmarks.
Mm-hmm. That would be great work to do. And there again, I'll make a note of that. As far as I know, it hasn't been done. Of course, a person could look at their test scores and see how they look, but as far as I know, that direct connection is not being made now. It would be a good one to point up, though, in our next report.
Thank you.
The co-chair actually did have a couple of questions, and I think you will actually have more questions than most of the people that will testify, given that you're the chair of the Quality Education Commission and given the fact that you're widely respected in that role. One of the questions I had was, the commission did make some specific recommendations to the legislature in their last report, and we funded some of those but did not fund others. For example, I'll just list them as briefly as I can. You listed top priorities. One of them was the PK-20 data system, which is actually funded. Mm-hmm. The money is set aside in the e-board, and hopefully the money will be released from the e-board for that purpose. I believe those decisions will be made sometime in the relatively near future. I didn't see any evidence on your second one that we actually put anything in place that was significant in terms of a governance and accountability task force that was largely to look at maximizing learning outcomes for students. And also, we didn't really provide or target any resources to the elementary grades, as we may have done in the past, emphasize early reading programs. On your secondary priorities, we really didn't provide any resources for the restructuring of the high school curriculum and restructuring the whole system of high schools that we had. We didn't provide any additional resources for targeting staff development. We did do a little bit of legislation trying to improve the alignment between K through 12 school curriculum and Oregon's post-secondary education system.
Mm-hmm.
And we did, fortunately, in the final hours of the session, we did continue the special funding for special needs children, high needs children. But in general, I think you did make a pretty clear attempt to say what your priorities were in terms of additional funding, and unfortunately we didn't actually meet all of those. One of the questions I had, though, is your report came out in December, and obviously the governor's budget came out in December. How do you coordinate your recommendations with the governor's budget?
That's a great question, one which I think I can answer. We do a preliminary report in August and get it to the governor. It contains typically the basic elements of what our report will be, and then we just sort of polish it up and add all the reports of the panels and finish it by December 1.
Okay.
We are deeply grateful for the funding that you did to our data system plan, and I believe that has the promise of providing more and better data so that we can make wise decisions about what to do, and also continuing the funding for special needs. Those go a long way to helping get where we need to be.
The second question I had was relative to, there's an interesting portion of your report that talks about essential budget level, which is sort of the new euphemism that we use in terms of current service level.
Right.
And it basically makes the point that what we have done is, while we are actually about $2 billion away from, or a little bit less than that, because the legislature actually funded higher than the governor's recommendation, so we're probably about $1.7 or $1.8 billion away from the quality education model figure. But we're still, in terms of, it depends on how you look at essential budget level. The case that you were making in your report, which I think is a valid case, is that Representative Morgan and I serve on the School Revenue Forecast Committee, and basically all we're trying to do in that committee is trying to determine from the last biennium to this biennium what it will take to continue those that level of services.
Mm-hmm.
But because we haven't met that essential budget level in either of the two prior bienniums to that, the overall level has fallen, and we're actually mm-hmm. funding, we can consider it an essential budget level in terms of continuing services from 0305 to 0507, but in reality we're well below where we were in 9901.
Yes.
Can you comment on that in terms of that we've actually, since the inception of this model and since the inception of these reports, we have actually declined in our level of being able to meet the service requirements or meet the educational requirements of Oregon school children? We have not actually improved, we've declined.
Well, it really is true, I believe, and we all know that the state has been through some hard times, and so that's one of the reasons. I believe there are other reasons for the fact that we have dropped behind. One is political will, just simple political will. Are we looking at how much we're spending, how much we're increasing spending, or are we really looking at the needs of students? And are we looking at the goals we've set and whether we have any chance of achieving them? I think those are two very different ways of looking at the process. And so I think that's one of the reasons, political will. How do you change political will? I believe one of the ways you change it is by communicating better what the needs are, communicating with the public so that they understand this very complicated system in the first place. Communicating. We can't do too much of it, and we certainly haven't done enough in the past. So the political will hasn't been there from the public side either, because I believe they largely don't understand. I believe also that there's some concurrence that the state needs to look at how they generate revenue. And, of course, those questions are really outside the purview of the commission, but I can tell you how disappointed we are that there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of progress being made in closing the gap. We believe that the students of Oregon would be in a much better place if there were some efforts being made.
Any additional questions for Ms. Massey?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you. This comes to my mind at the moment because of the question the co-chair just asked you and the answer that you gave. I was reading a very fine editorial that was in the Oregonian on New Year's Day called Oregon, State of Wrong Choices. Oregonians are showing signs they are finally ready to push for a better home. And his first paragraph, Doug Bates wrote this, and he used to work at the Register Guard, which is where my husband works, so he does come from a good newspaper. But he says, if we're fortunate, 2005 will be remembered as the year Oregonians woke up and started asking the right questions. And then he goes on about that issue that you just talked about, what kind of schools, what kind of state do we want to live in?
Right.
And I think Oregonians did wake up. There was enough scandal and reform and issues that woke them up from their slumber, and we have a public commission on the legislature that hopefully is going to turn this institution around and give it some meaning to people out there. I think it is quite meaningful, but somehow it's not been that way. And I think your point is well taken about political will and changing the communication. And so I just would urge you to continue to partnership with Chalkboard and whatever ways you can in our communities to make sure that we continue to do that. I think that's one of the answers.
Thank you.
Seeing no additional questions, thank you very much, Ms. Massey.
And thank you. It's been a pleasure to visit with you, and I hope it helps.
Thank you. Mr. Reeder and Ms. Burke, would you like to come together forward together? Welcome. And Mr. Burke, why don't you start off? And again, we'll hold questions. In fact, in this case, I think we'll hold questions until both of you speak. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. For your record, I'm Pat Burke. I'm the Chief Policy Officer of the Department of Education. I just will make a very, very brief statement. We are committed in the work of the commission this year to basic and fundamental concept of relevance to the legislature. The legislature considered a bill in the last session, Senate Bill 38, that would have redefined the function of the Quality Education Commission. We considered, the department supported that bill, actually, the reason was, as we talked with Senator Morse, who was the chief sponsor of the bill, that some of the conversation that you've just had with Susan Massey begin to sense this drift of relevance of the work of the commission away from the essential and fundamental work of the legislature. That's not good for the commission, and obviously I don't think it helps inform the work of the legislature either. The model, I was part of the legislative task force prior to the existence of the commission, when Representative Lundquist chaired the Legislative Council on School Finance that eventually led to the passage of the model and the creation of the commission by the governor at the time. The work then was focused on trying to get a handle on what are the indicators financially and programmatically that lead to quality schools. And that was the original work of the commission. And the model was based on an analysis of the research at the time. And then we had tools at the time. My colleague Brian Reeder was very involved in helping create those tools. We had new tools that let us ask questions of the finance system. How much would some of those indicators cost? And the model was designed to use what was at the time a new tool, the Database Initiative, DBI, that allowed for the first time the collection of comparable data on each of the school districts across the state so that we could ask fundamental questions like, if class size is related to school quality, what's the current class size, what does it cost, and what would it take to lower class size? And we didn't have the ability to ask those questions prior to that, the existence of the model in the beginning. So from the very beginning, I just want to make a very simple point here. From the very beginning, the work of the commission has been about analysis and decision-making. It has not necessarily been about promoting a particular model. So that idea of do we need to add $2 billion more just to get to zero has never really been part of the work of the Commission. The work of the Commission has been more analytical. What are our goals? And what would it take to achieve those goals? And what are some of the predictors of success to get to those goals? And then to create tools that help us analyze those fundamental questions. So the Commission in its first meetings this year, there have been two meetings so far this year, and Senator Morse was at our last meeting. We had a very lengthy conversation with Senator Morse about his perception of what the legislature would need in the coming year. And as Susan Massey just described to you, this taking some time to really look historically at where we have been over the last decade, what are we spending, what are we getting for that, and what options and implications are there that the model can help inform. So there are statutory requirements that we will, of course, meet. When the commission was created by the governor and approved by the legislature, one of the statutory requirements is that the model itself be updated on a biennial basis. So we will do that. We have a statutory requirement to do that. So you will see new numbers. But I would urge us all, both members of the commission and the legislature, to not get hung up on the new number. The real issue is, what do we know about what we have been spending? What are our current challenges and what choices do we have? And I can tell you that the members of the commission and certainly the staff that support the commission are dedicated to trying to make our information as relevant as possible to the decisions that you will be facing in the coming session. So I'll stop there, Mr. Chair. See if Brian has something he wants to add.
Mr. Reeder?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Reeder, Assistant Superintendent for Analysis and Reporting at the Department of Education. I'll just be very brief and sort of emphasize a couple things that Pat said. And the first is a point that Co-Chair Flores made, and that the model is really a tool to help us understand things better. Early on when the commission was first formed, and one of the charges of the commission was to estimate how much funding is required to meet the goals in Oregon statute, and most people in the state were fairly shocked at how high that number was relative to the level of funding we're currently at. And we've tended to get caught up in that single number of how much it would take to fully fund the model. But I truly believe that the power of the model is not related to that big number, but it's related to what the model can teach us about how we're spending our money in Oregon schools, what we're getting out of the system in terms of student performance, and to help us understand where additional investments will have the most impact on improving student performance. So I would agree with Representative Flores entirely. The model is a tool. It helps us to understand the situation we're in, and it helps guide us in terms of where we need to go to improve outcomes for kids. I guess with that, we'll take any questions you may have.
Questions? Representative Abakian.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate your description of it to be used as a model. But from your perspective, is it implicit that that number does mean something? Meaning, do you have confidence that that number accurately reflects the amount of money necessary in order to provide the quality education system that the model represents?
Mm-hmm. Senator Devlin, Representative Vakian. The model is based on, the level of resources that the model represents or designates as being required to achieve the student outcome goals is based on
a rather large body of research that says, you know, quality teachers lead to better outcomes, smaller class sizes lead to better outcomes, added professional development helps improve teacher effectiveness and so forth. So in that sense, the level of resources and the amount of money required that the model estimates is based on the best research that's out there. So in that sense, I think we have as much confidence as we can that the level of resources and the way that they are used is consistent with the best knowledge available. So, you know, you can never have complete confidence in a forecast or in an estimate that is something beyond a situation where you've ever been. But I think based on what we know and what we've learned from the research that we have as much confidence as we can. I mean, I feel confident that the model is based on good research and a very thorough review of that research.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I could just add a quick point, Representative Avakian, there of states that do this kind of work, and there are about 18 states in the United States that have some form of something like a quality education commission. There are three basic models, and they generate three different types of information. So my answer to your question, in addition to what Brian said, is that it really depends on what questions are being asked. For example, one of the approaches is to look at what some states consider to be a best practices model. So it's not a comprehensive model the way the Oregon model is. So you might look at things like early childhood education or after-school tutoring programs. And they will look at the model and say, what would it cost to have high-quality early childhood education for all of the schools in the state? And then those commissions or those bodies prepare forecasts using that type of approach. The second approach is sometimes called an expert approach, which is the approach that Oregon took, which is to review the literature and to look at as much research as possible in all of the different elements that go into high-quality schools. So it's more comprehensive. And then to ask, what are we currently spending on those things? And if we were to expand them or to increase them, what would that cost? That's sometimes called an expert model. And there's a third model, which looks, and some states have used it, which is called an empirical model, which is to go out to the schools in a state, look at the high-performing schools, identify what they do, calculate the cost of what they do, and then to build a model on what that would take to do everywhere. So they're basically three models, and they end up generating three different scenarios of how much it costs. So one of the things that I think the model allows us to do is say, my answer to your question is yes, it is a very good model for high quality schools in the state, and it assumes that you would be doing everything that we know about the literature and the research on high quality schools. Now, whether or not that is a realistic target, given the political and financial realities of the state, is a different matter. But as a summation of what the research says and what that might cost in the state of Oregon, it's pretty accurate. Then the question is, what do we use that information for? And I think what I was trying to say earlier is that what we hope to be able to do with the commission is use that information more analytically in a more relevant way to answer questions that you and other members of the legislature might have. But as if you were to look at a comprehensive model of high-quality schools based on the research, it's a pretty good model. But it's assuming that what I'm trying to say is if you did absolutely everything that the literature would say would be good for kids, what would that cost to do it in every state, in every school, excuse me, in every district in the state? That's what it would cost.
Any questions?
I do.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. And Dr. Burke, it's good to see you. Glad to see you're well. And Mr. Reeder, thank you very much both. Question, just for clarification here. Now, when we talk about those components of the quality education model, it's my recollection and from reading in our prior discussions that capital construction costs are not included in the quality education model. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So safely, I think one estimate or one figure that I saw at some report based on in a legislative report, it could add an additional $3 billion if we were to include capital construction costs. Is that correct?
It could. Capital cost, and Brian is much more expertise in this area than I have, but capital costs are tricky because of shifting enrollments. Capital cost impacts some districts much more than others currently. While some districts in the state may be closing schools, other districts in the state have a need to increase their space. So it doesn't impact schools in a uniform way, the way the components of the model itself tend to impact schools in a more uniform way. Teacher quality, class size, full-time versus part-time kindergarten, those types of questions impact all schools relatively equally. The other thing is that the basic question had to do with the allocation of the state school fund, and capital costs, as you know, can be bonded outside of the state school fund, so it was somewhat different than where the basic question of where the money went from the legislature.
Follow up?
Yes.
In that same context as well, it's not. It's my recollection that maintenance costs and those types of things are not included in the quality education model, and or increased staffing and desks and books and things for. They are included in there.
They are.
Co-Chair Flores, yes, they are. Operations and maintenance, which typically is energy costs, cleaning costs for school buildings and so forth, are included in the model, as are textbooks and supplies and other things needed in classrooms. So, yes, other than the buildings themselves, the model is pretty comprehensive in what it includes.
Okay. Last follow-up?
Yes.
Thank you. Then, if we were to consider Representative Avakian's recommendations for inclusion and then capital construction costs in the same context of the QEM, we could be increasing by in excess of $3 billion to what it currently is, which I think was, 7.1 is the last recommendation, so we're at over $10 billion. And if in the Brigadoon scenario we had that money to give to allocate to the various schools and districts, is there anything that the model says these schools need to spend the money pursuant to the model? In other words, if we just handed them carte blanche, here's everything that you needed in a best-case scenario, is there anything that says you have to spend it this way?
Co-Chair Flores, there's nothing in Oregon law that tells districts how they have to spend their money. And there's the model is a... in some sense, a representation of the effective use of resources. And so if a district is spending its money radically different than what the model looks like and getting very poor results, we might want to ask, why are you spending your money that way? But there's nothing in the law that forces them to spend their money the way the model says or the way the legislature says, until there's legislation requiring them to spend money in a particular way, under Oregon law, they are free to allocate their resources the way they feel is best for their particular circumstances. Now, backing up a little bit, Representative Avakian mentioned fees that have increased in some cases fairly dramatically. Those fees are in the model. We pick those up in the model, so that would not represent an increase in a funding requirement. Let me back up. The the state is not paying for those fees now. Families are, but those are included in the $7 billion amount that is in the model. So that has been taken into account, as have the out-of-pocket expenses paid by teachers. That amount of money is picked up in the model as well.
Mr. Reeder, can you clarify so that it's understood? It's in the model in the sense that you believe that that is already being paid for in one way or the other.
No, it's in the model in the sense that the model recommends that funding be provided for that. Instead of asking teachers to spend their own money for supplies, the model, in a sense, says the state or the government, either state or local, should pick up those expenses, and those expenses are included in the fully implemented amount, the $7.1 billion. They would not be included in what we call the baseline, which is what we're actually spending, because, in fact, the state is not picking up those expenses. They are being picked up by teachers or families.
I have one more question.
Okay.
I know I said that was a final. And please help me recall, does the model in its estimations determine that we would have additional teachers if we were to reduce class sizes based on the recommendation? Do we have adequate teachers to staff at the model or the level that would be recommended in this best case scenario?
Co-Chair Flores, the answer is no. The class size recommendations in the model are in many districts far exceeded currently. For example, the kindergarten recommendations are around 20 a section. For a half-day section, many of our kindergarten classes are much larger than 20. The high school numbers are around 25 a section in the model. And in many of our high schools, we have classes far in excess of that. But it's a good example of the question that you asked earlier, which I thought was kind of right on target with the model. Many of you, are familiar with the example in California, where the California legislature enacted a class size reduction initiative but barred any of the money from being used for capital costs. So that many districts in California found themselves in exactly the position that I think you were describing, Representative Flores, in that they had money to lower class size and hire more teachers, but they had no money to build classrooms. So one of the things that the model allows is what would be the impact of lowering class size to a certain level. We can analyze current population and what level of staffing would it take to get to a certain ratio. It does not do a very good job of estimating how many new classrooms would be required and what the cost of that might be, and that would be a capital cost. And therein lies part of the problem that some of our districts face right now, in that they have money in their current budgets, in some cases, where they could hire more teachers, but they don't have the space for the teachers. So they end up hiring instructional aides or taking other steps to help mitigate the large class size. What they'd really like to do is build a new building or to expand an existing building, but that usually would require bonded indebtedness that many of the districts have been unable to secure. So I think the model helps ask and inform exactly the kind of question that you're asking. It's a very good example of how the model could help inform those decisions at the legislative level.
Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes.
I know I said that was the last one. I feel like Senator Walker now. I've seen you do exactly that. Since we have the department here, might I ask a couple of questions? Beginning, I guess, early last year, the superintendent had been responding to various data that had been coming in showing that there had been some progress made in numerous areas as far as student achievement, closing the achievement gap. And I guess I wanted to address this just because there was some inference that, you know, we're shorting our students on education, a quality education, and yet we are showing significant improvements. And some of the references that the superintendent had made did not make reference to the quality education model, but on the redirection of the resources that were currently being used. Would you care that were currently available? Would you care to comment on that?
It's a complex area, Co-Chair Flores. The part of the work of the commission that I talked about and that Susan Massey talked about was to really, we would like to get into more detail and actually looking at exactly the question that you just raised. But initially, what we're seeing is that, yes, indeed, especially at the elementary level, our teachers continue to be successful in moving more students to standard. At third grade, we're up around 90% this year, and that's very high nationally, and it's the highest levels that we've achieved in Oregon. Fifth grade standards are slightly less, around 78-79%. The middle school and high school level, they are lower, as they have traditionally been, but at both the middle school and high school level, we are seeing significant gains. We are particularly pleased in the last data to see really all, what I would describe as remarkable improvement for limited English proficient students. We saw double-digit improvement at the elementary level for LEP students. So I think we can all be proud of the work that Oregon teachers are doing. Now, I believe that one of the things that has happened is that the focus both at the state level and national level on improving achievement and closing the achievement gap has meant that districts are concentrating in those areas, which means that cuts in their programs have occurred elsewhere. So we see fewer music teachers. We see fewer full-time PE teachers. We see fewer full-time art teachers. So the argument, I believe, that we all share as a community is what does a quality school program contain? Not just whether or not kids are meeting benchmarks in reading and mathematics, but should all students have a PE teacher? And should all students have a librarian available to them? And those are questions that the model can help answer. We can have a pretty good idea of what it would cost to provide that level of service. And getting back to Representative Avakian's question, that's why the model appears to be high. The model assumes that all of that is in place. The model assumes that there is a librarian and a PE teacher and a music teacher and a counselor and a class size of a certain level. It puts all of that in place and say, what would it cost to fund all of that? So what I think you're seeing, what all of us are seeing, is that districts have made decisions on where to concentrate their limited resources. They are focusing on closing the gap. They know they're being held accountable for student improvement, and that's where the money has gone, and we're seeing results. I think the question is, what have we cut in order to maintain that?
Follow up. Thank you. And it is, I would agree that those arts components are very important to the well-rounding of our individuals. And that's not my focus here. And I guess what triggered my thought in that regard is seeing that students, as they move from their secondary education, their high school education, into community college or four-year university work, very high, I feel, number of students, up to almost 40%, are needing to be remediated, and that's not in arts education or physical education. That is in core education areas.
Correct. Representative Flores, you're absolutely correct, and it is something that we also share with you. We're concerned about that. Indeed, that's been part of the work of the joint boards, and I hope this committee may at some point we might want to talk with members of the joint boards about better system integration and alignment of curriculum and instructional issues. We, as you know, are working on a data management system that would link the three institutions that you mentioned. Part of that design provides a feedback loop to the high school where the student graduated from so that we know how well those students are being prepared for Oregon colleges and universities. We know that there is a financial impact both on Oregon families and on our higher education institutions to provide the remedial instruction that you're describing at the high school, at the university level. It is a source of frustration to all of us. These are all students who entered high school with a 3.8, 3.5 grade point average, with good SAT scores, with letters of recommendation from staff and the community, and at least we know from two studies that have been done is that when students achieved state standard in the 10th grade, their chance of high school or university success in Oregon were dramatically improved based on the analysis that we've done. But you're correct that far too many of our kids are going into higher education still in need of additional help. And the system alignment work between K-12 and the university and community college community is very much on the front burner for both the K-12 board and the higher education board.
Thank you.
One thing for the committee. I have two parties that need to leave soon after 11, and they're not the two parties that are testifying now. So I'll go to one or two more questions, and then I'll have one final question, and then we'll go to the two parties that have to leave. So, Representative Morgan.
Thank you. Just kind of pulling the conversation back to the model itself. First of all, thank you both for the work that you, I mean, the hours and hours that you put into talking to me about how the model works, and I particularly appreciate Mr. Reeder's patience when I chaired the education subcommittee in helping me understand the nature of the TUA. One of the discussions that we had at that point, and I'm curious on where the discussion is now, is that on the revenue side, there are all those components that go into coming up with the number that it would take to fund that level of education. On the revenue side, we always get stuck into a discussion about the general fund appropriation to the state school fund or the legislature's appropriation to the state school fund. And we don't often spend a lot of time talking about the local property tax component, the federal funds component, or all of what I call the mystery money, the money that just kind of appears in different places. Where is that now in the way that the model is looked at?
Representative Morgan, currently the way, and this is has always been the case with the model looks at how much it would cost to do what the commission thinks is, or create what the commission thinks are high quality schools, independent of where the money comes from. How much does it cost to do those things? And once that is determined, then you look at your revenue sources and say, well, we expect this much money from the federal government, and we expect this much money from local sources such as property taxes, and that leaves this much money remaining to be paid, or this, you know, and that. In Oregon, the state of Oregon is the funder of last resort. So that's where if additional money is to be had for education, it needs to come from the state. That's the way the model works. It says, here's what it costs, here's the federal money, here's the local money. That means the state needs to come up with this much if the model is to be fully funded. So that's the way the revenue sources come into the picture. Now, your comment about the mystery money, one of my goals for the upcoming session is that we do a much better job of demonstrating where all the money comes from and not just talk about the state school fund, but sort of get a comprehensive look at all of the revenue sources that are available to education in Oregon so that we're all looking at all the numbers, not just part of them.
So then is it a correct statement to make that the funding level that the Quality Education Commission puts out in their report doesn't reflect the total cost of getting 90% of the students to the conformance with the standards? It only represents that part of it that the state that the legislature is responsible for providing?
Representative Morgan, no, it represents the full amount. And then it determines what share of that or what portion of that needs to come from the state in order for the model to be fully funded.
So the total amount of the education then is a higher number than the number that the Quality Education Commission puts out in their report?
Well, the commission's report, the table that shows the funding requirement, it shows the full amount, which is somewhere around $10 billion. And then it takes out local revenue and federal revenue to arrive at the roughly $7.1 billion that would be required from the state school fund.
Okay. Thank you. And then the next question I had was around the tracking between what actually is going on in the districts and what the quality education model suggests for the 90% attainment of standards. Can you talk to us about where the district is in I understand that you use the DBI to help truth up the model itself. But what is the conversation between the outcome of the Quality Education Commission's work and the way that the school districts actually allocate their resources? What's the quality of the discussion between the department and the districts?
Representative Morgan, as Susan Massey mentioned, there are a number of districts, and it's not a large number, it's maybe a handful, that have started looking at the model and comparing their actual spending in those various categories to what's in the model to get a sense for how their allocation of resources to various uses compares to what the model sort of recommends. One thing the commission has talked about in its initial meetings in this current round is that we actually do that comparison for all the districts in the state, that we present data for each district in the same category that the model uses to get a sense for just where the districts are relative to the model itself in terms of
comparing percentages.
Percentages across different uses. Now, mm-hmm. keep in mind that even if they spend the model in the same way, or spend the money in the same way the model recommends, they aren't going to have the same level of resources that the model recommends.
And is there anything being done to correlate districts that are closer to the model and farther away from the model and comparing the levels that students are attaining in the assessments?
We have not done any of that work. That work would remain to be done. It certainly would be interesting work to know, or interesting information to know that whether different allocations, you know, more professional development versus lower class sizes, which of those has the most beneficial impact. Those sorts of analyses are quite complex, but it's something that the department has made some initial attempts at. One example would be the work that we did around ESL spending and the effectiveness of greater spending on ESL programs with regard to the performance of ESL students. That's an example of that type of work, but it's really in its infancy right now.
And one more question for Mr. Burke. You mentioned that there were 18 or 19 states that are doing the same kind of modeling. In those other models, is there also the large discrepancy between the appropriation and the model request?
In two of the three, Representative Morgan, in two of the three, yes. The one difference is that states that sort of pick a particular strategy, like lowering class size or all-day kindergarten, that in those models, they can be fairly precise about what that is going to cost, so there's not much discrepancy. But in the other two models, that looking at both an empirical analysis of schools in the state that are high-performing or an expert model looking at their recommendations, in every case, they exceed what states normally invest.
Is the gap as large as our gap is?
That's a very good question. I'd have to go back, and I don't think I have seen an analysis of the specific numbers of the gaps. The last year, right about this time, a publication by Education Week called Quality Counts. One just came out this week from Education Week. That same report that came out last year was devoted exclusively to state finance analysis. And there's a wealth of data in there comparing every state in the United States on what they spend it on. And it has that's where a lot of the information about models like the QEC is contained in there.
Thank you.
Okay, one final question from Mr. Riley, and then we will go to someone else.
Thank you. I want to follow up just briefly. Is it fair to say that there is no school in the state that is funded the way the quality education model would have them funded, and therefore really no school to study to see what the effect is?
Why?
Senator Devlin, Representative Riley, I would say, as you know, the model is based on prototype schools, and the size of those schools. The elementary school is about 340 students, the middle school is 500 students, and the high school is 1,000 students. And I would say of schools, actual schools in Oregon that are of that size, we probably don't have one. We probably don't have any that are funded as well as the model recommends. Now, we do have a lot of very small schools in Oregon. We have schools that have three or four students in them. Those schools, because of the way our funding formula works, have a great deal of money per student, on the order of $20,000 to $30,000 per student. I think it would be unfair to use those as examples of you know, whether the model is accurate or not, because they are so far, they are so different than most schools in the state. But I think it's an accurate statement that really there are no schools in Oregon that are funded as well as the model recommends.
Okay. Mr. Burke, Mr. Reeder, would it be possible for both of you to come back this afternoon? We may have some questions for you. For the sake of the people here to testify, we will be recessing from 12:30 to 1:30 for lunch. We hope to get to most of the invited testimony before we recess. I would actually put one thing on the record, because it's kind of the prerogative of the chair to put one thing on the record, and maybe I can get a comment from Mr. Burke. The state has never taken any clear, or doesn't currently take any clear responsibility for the capital needs of school districts. The only need that I know that they have addressed to a slight degree is one, the $17 million that we've set aside in the formula, which will be $25 million in the next, which takes care of some of the capital needs in terms of like desks and other things that schools need that are building new facilities. And also, I believe in the Education Stability Fund, if we meet, once we get to the 5% level, proceeds beyond that are supposed to go into a fund for capital needs for school districts. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Just wanted to get that on the record. Thank you very much. We do have a request from two people that have to leave relatively soon. So Mr. Scherzinger and Ms. Hildix, will you come forward? And they have been good enough to provide written copies of their testimony. Please.
Good morning, Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Flores, and members of the committee. My name is Sue Hildick, and I'm the president of the Chalkboard Project. And I'm delighted to have Jim Scherzinger here with me, who's been helping the Chalkboard Project take a look at school finance issues. And let me just set a little context. We know you're looking at the QEM today. We're looking at it, too. I just want to remind you where we are in our process. Chalkboard's been at it for about 18 months, and we put out in June a 15-point action plan. Two of the items on the plan are items that we're spending a lot more time looking at. One was school finance. The other is quality educators and administrators. And we have two work groups that have been formed looking at those issues. They are both due to report to us at the end of January, and so we're coming very close to that date. Jim has been chairing the finance group, which is a group of school finance experts and business folks that we brought together and gave a very large charge to, which he'll explain. But basically, the overall goal from Chalkboard's perspective and the question we ask the group is, how do we provide funding that is efficient and sufficient for every publicly funded child to be a successful student in Oregon, no matter where they are? Large charge, and we ask them to look at it from several different slices: stability, adequacy, transparency, efficiencies, accountability, and sort of the whole gambit of questions. So I think at this point I'll ask Jim to fill you in on where we are.
Okay, thank you. Jim Scherzinger, working for the Chalkboard Project. I want to thank the chairs for letting us come up early. The reason for me is that I have a meeting over at DHS that I need to get to. And so actually, what?
You have my condolences.
After that, I will be around in the Capitol after that, so if you have more questions, I could come back in the afternoon if you have some questions you'd like me to answer. Let me just say really quickly, Sue did describe our charge as broader than the question of adequacy. So we're looking at all of the stability, equity, transparency, efficiency issues in addition to adequacy. I understand your focus today is more on adequacy, so I'll talk briefly about that. Our particular mission, and I think it's important to stress the mission, is that is to examine these questions, including adequacy, given that we have a set of goals for achievement for kids. In other words, that we need to be able to talk about adequacy and these other issues in terms of how it will achieve a particular goal. And so it's a function of what that goal is. What is the educational goal that we have? And so that as you look at adequacy and you try to implement that, you run into lots of problems, lots of issues. Now, the quality education model is an example of an attempt to try to structurally build a model that will relate outcomes to funding. And say, if you funded in this way, you would get this kind of outcome. Now, I think the important thing about it isn't so much about the first question isn't so much whether or not that particular way is the right way of doing it. It's that, is this the right thing to be doing in the first place? In other words, do we want to try to tie funding to outcomes? Now, if we agree that we need to do that and want to do that, then it becomes a question of what's the best way of doing that, not whether to do it at all. And personally, I believe, and I think our mission as a group is to say that we do want to be able to know that if we spend the money, that we're going to get the outcomes that we want. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily the quality education model is the best way to do it. But it does mean that you need to have some sort of ongoing process that helps you try to relate those two things to assure you that you get the outcomes that you want. Now, as we looked at that question, we are trying to look at lots of different ways that you might make a judgment about whether funding is adequate. Quality education model is one way. Looking at what other states spend on education is another way. Looking at doing a forecast over the next 10 years of what our revenue is going to be and what our costs are going to grow and what kind of efficiencies can we get out of our current system from a sort of a business point of view, a business financial point of view. Looking at what the costs are of particular initiatives, in some cases things that Chalkboard believes that research shows would improve educational outcomes, what would those cost? looking at the costs of what the teacher quality administrator quality group would recommend and what those things would cost. All of those are elements of how you, we're trying to get together all in one place all of the sort of standards that one might use to make a judgment about what adequate is, given that your focus is to improve educational outcomes. Now, having said that, and we'll talk about the pros and cons of each one of that, and I won't get into any of that unless you want to ask that kind of question. I won't sort of present that. Obviously, we're not even done with what we're doing, so you'd get a sort of a pre-version anyway. But that's what our focus is to try to lay out what all the different ways of looking at it are. And what we end up with is what we're calling a broom, which is if you follow this path, this is what it would cost. If you follow this path, this is what it would cost, that sort of thing, using the sort of standards that I just talked about. Ultimately, the judgment is being made by you or by the public at large about what path to follow. And Chalkboard will have a recommendation, I'm sure, about what that path is, and a process to help others talk about it. But that's basically what we're about. So I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Let me just add one last thing. We have been working on a transparency piece around school spending, and I handed this out to you in our packet. It's called the Open Book Project, and it's a collaborative effort between OSBA, COSA, Citizens for Oregon's Future, Department of Education, OEA, and Chalkboard. We've been working to try to answer one of the things Chalkboard heard loudly in our round of citizen engagement, which is, how does the average citizen get a handle on school spending? Where is an easy place to go? Simplified information. And what we have done is create a website that is attached to the Department of Ed's website, and you access it by going to your school district homepage, and you'll see an icon there that says Open Book. You can click on that, and you get what you're seeing here, which are screenshots, which give you a sense of school spending for your district, and it allows you to compare with other districts. There's a comparator tool where you can choose amongst your peer group, which we're defining by size at this point. It's first generation. We hope to have other ways to cut it, but right now by size. And you can select districts of similar size. You can look at the state average. You can look at your peer group average. You can also connect to the Oregon Report Card and look at achievement data for your district to try to give citizens a sense of the basic information for their district in an easy-to-use manner. And I wanted to make sure that you were aware of it. This is another one of our action items. Shouldn't take legislative assistance. We're trying to move this outside the legislative process, but we're pretty excited to launch it next week.
One more maybe just big picture, because I think it gives a sense of where we're coming from as a committee, is that one thing that we're very conscious of is that funding isn't everything when it comes to schools. The parallel that I like to draw is that there is agreement about some things in education, and one of them is that there's a fairly good agreement about what the qualities of an effective school are, that quality teachers, strong administration, parental involvement in the school, the same kinds of things that Chalkboard has come up with when he talked to people. What there's not necessarily agreement about is how do you manage to get that in every school. To me, it's the equivalent of the type of management problem that you have when you're trying to get everybody to have a quality doctor. You want everybody to have a quality professional in the classroom, in the building, to provide the education that those kids need. Same sort of management problem as getting a quality doctor in front of every person that needs one. But when you really look at the goals of education versus, you know, I think there's more agreement about what a good medical outcome is than there is about what a good educational outcome. There's more agreement about what good medical technique. There's more there's more rigorous research on how to get good medical outcomes than there is in education. So we're trying to make a funding decision in the midst of a world, a real world, in which there is less agreement about these things than there is in the medical field, even though the management problem is essentially the same. So we have to always recognize that when we're talking about funding, that this has got to be an ongoing process. The state of educational research will improve greatly over time. It's only relatively recently that we, only in Oregon since 1990 and then nationally even later than that, that we have told schools that they're accountable for the outcomes of their students. That wasn't the theory of education before school reform. The theory of education was that you provided the best program you can, but you really sort the kids out. You're not responsible that all kids learn. And that if a child doesn't learn, that was their problem. And so a big part of the increases in achievement we've seen recently is because we're just saying that this is the goal that we have. Teachers and principals and other administrators in the system are responding to that goal. And we've gotten significant progress. To me, what that means is that schools are getting more efficient at producing these kinds of outcomes. If you get more efficient, that ought to lead, if you really want to get to the goals you have. I don't know what our numbers will end up showing necessarily, but the tendency in the private sector is to do more investment when you get more efficiency. But you need to be able to sort those issues out. And I think education is one area where there will be a lot learned about what gets you to good educational outcomes over the next few years. And you need to have the capacity of implementing that within the system. And that's and you need to have a funding mechanism that doesn't get in the way of those kinds of improvements.
Mr. Riley?
Just one brief question. Do you believe, for the Chalkboard Project, believe that the measurements that we now use accurately reflect a good educational outcome?
Well, I don't know what Chalkboard believes. I know what I believe. I mean, I believe that you need a measurement. I believe that the measurements we largely have because they're the least expensive ones we can get, and that you can get better ones, but they will cost you more money. And that's you're on the horns of a dilemma in that regard. But if you're going to hold the system accountable for achieving results, you need to define what results you want, and you need to have a way of assessing whether or not we're getting to those results. And just saying that you're not going to have a way of doing that is not going to get you the results you want.
Quick follow-up. What I guess I was really asking is, I agree, we do have to have ways to measure if we're getting the results we want. The question I really was asking is, do you believe that we're measuring the right outcomes? In other words, some people would say, if we can read and write and do arithmetic, then we've done our job. Other people would say, no, as Co-Chair Flores has said, there's something called a well-rounded student. And is it your belief that is what we're doing is a correct measurement, or should we be measuring something more?
Well, I believe reading and writing and mathematics are the core. That you need to be able to do those things because they're the sort of the key to learning in other areas. On the other hand, just purely from an economic perspective, just those things are not is what's going to move the economy. And that We have, I believe, we have, we don't necessarily agree on what they are, but I think we have higher goals for what we want our kids to achieve. And we can agree on the minimums. I think that's easy, relatively easy to get agreement on the minimums. But once you start talking about, you know, do you want character education? Do you want, you know, what's the best way of getting kids to think creatively or to think critically or to participate in the political process or what they ought to think about patriotism? Or when you start getting into those kinds of issues, you end up in a fair amount of disagreement. And in addition to a difficulty in how you assess those things, I mean, how do you assess the character of a student? Not you can't do it, it's just more difficult. And I believe that if you ask a lot of people, they all have those kinds of goals for education, but we don't agree on what they are. And that's why I say that it's easier to agree on a good medical outcome than it is on a good educational outcome. So as a society, if we could reach better agreement on those things, I think we would be better off.
Representative Morgan and then Representative Avakian.
Just very quickly, back to what you described as the horns of the dilemma in the funding discussion. I know that up front of your process, you did a very exhaustive job of surveying, and that you did a lot of work on trying to survey a representative group of Oregonians that was indicative of what was out there in the real world. And I'm wondering if you could very briefly share with us what you found when you talked to them about how they wanted to fund schools.
Well, I think what we found, first and foremost, no surprise, is it's the area where Oregon is most divided. We saw nearly an even split between those who feel schools have enough money and aren't spending it efficiently to those who feel that they're underfunded. And what we found was there were a lot of people who struggled with answering that question, and thus things like Open Book and other things to try to elevate the amount of information that's out there. We also found, you know, statewide, and our polling was done with the general public, not just voters, but the general population, that Oregonians have very high hopes for their schools, that they want schools to be among the nation's best, and less than 50% feel we're there. So that's really the gap in which Chalkboard has been doing its work. We didn't see consensus around a funding path in our initial work, and we didn't push real hard on that either. We were asking questions around quality, accountability, and finance. That's why we've convened Jim's group, which is to drill deeper into the areas he's identified, bring that back to Chalkboard. Then we're going to have another round of public engagement. So Jim will report the end of January, as will our teacher group, which is chaired by Jay Kasbin from the Cascades campus of OSU. Those two groups report at the end of January. Chalkboard then goes out in late February back to the public with their findings. So we're going to have specific public engagement rounds around finance and around teacher and administrator quality issues.
Well, coming back to what you described as the kind of bifurcated opinion about they've got enough, they need more, did you find that that broke out in any specific demographic group or region, or how did that, what were the dynamics of that?
Yeah, I wish I had Adam Davis here with me to drill deeper. I can get you that. I think, you know, we saw parents had a closer feeling that schools needed more money, and we definitely saw that. And beyond that, I really can't tell you, but I could get you the breakouts.
Thank you.
Representative Levant.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Scherzinger, I appreciate many of the comments you made. I thought I knew very clearly where you were headed, but you said a couple things that I guess skewed my opinion. Maybe you can clarify them. Yeah. One of them is I think there are a lot of folks that don't view public education's main purpose as driving the economy, but simply just to develop well-rounded, responsible, conscientious citizens, and that a good economy is simply a result of that. Just like decreasing the prison population and the dependency on welfare programs and other things are simply a result of a well-rounded human being. And from that,
regarding Representative Riley's question, maybe you could discuss what the Chalkboard Project's definition of outcomes is. And I say that, or I ask that, because I think some would also question whether or not math, science, and English truly are the core, basic, sole areas that lead to other learning. As an example, numerous studies for decades have shown that music, arts, and physical education between grades pre-K and 3 greatly increase standardized test scores in those other areas. And when you don't have those other developmental subject areas at those early grades, you suffer in math, science, and reading ability later. So, one, please help define a little bit what you view as the purpose of public education, what your definition of outcomes are, and where those other subject areas fit in the necessity for children.
Okay, let me first clarify that the my sense of what I thought about the economy. And it's sort of the reverse of that. Yeah, and this is underneath the school reforms that both in the state and nationally is the underlying observation that if you don't reach a certain capacity to read, a capacity to do math, a capacity to do some of these things, that you will not fully participate in the economy of today. That is, that there are not jobs, there are not things to do that are adequate numbers of them that are allow you to fully participate unless you get to that sort of set of skills. And that that's different. That's something that's new and different compared to 20 or 30 years ago. And that's what's driven the push towards school reform, is that we can't be happy just getting 60% of these kids to standard, that those 40 that don't get there are not going to fully participate in economic life in this country if they don't. So I think it's more, it's not from the standpoint of it's good for the economy so much as it is for those kids who don't get there, they can't fully participate, and the goal is full participation of all. And that's really more, I think, where all the drive for school reform, or not all of it, but a good chunk of the drive for school reform has come from, that sort of central observation. So now I'm trying to go back to address your specific questions.
I'll help you, because I think you set it up nicely.
Right.
Although I would add, I suppose, that I think a large part of the push for school reform in this state and at the federal level was in order to hold schools accountable and figure out an objective gauge to compare them against each other and make them compete, which I'm not so sure is a healthy thing for the system. But based on what you just said, when we get to outcomes and the definition of outcomes, how do you include those other subject areas?
And that's a good question. Is that I would say this way, is that you have many kids, some kids, are going to learn no matter what you do. You give them access to resources, a library, you know, go talk to the teacher anytime you want, and they're going to learn. You don't have to help them at all, really. They'll do it on their own. If you want to educate all kids or get all kids to a standard, you have to use different techniques. Every kid learns differently. And you have to have the capacity of knowing what each child knows or doesn't know. You need to know how that child learns, and you need to provide the resources, the method to help that child learn. And it's different for every child. Some children will do just fine in a library with a book and will learn real well. Others will not, and they need more practical applications. So service learning, you know, a true service learning type of program where they're out in the world working with real things will help them learn. Some students will help, the arts and music and those kinds of things will help them learn. It's different for every child, and you need to have the capacity to know what it is that helps that child learn and to provide it. And that's the only way. And in some cases, it's social services. Some children are not going to learn unless the social situation that they're in changes. And that's something maybe schools can't even directly do anything about. That's a social service issue, that a better integration of school services with the social services of the county or the state to solve some of the, you know, if they're not eating, they're not going to learn. If there's a drug problem in the house, there are going to be limitations on their ability to learn. And so if we really want to get every kid to standard, we have to have systems to deal with. And not, that's not simply a school problem. It's a social service problem. It's an issue of how schools relate to social services, how they relate to parents, and how they can help parents help them help their children learn. It's not something schools can do on their own. They will never have the resources to do that if you really want to get every kid to standard. So that's the way I would say it. It's not simply a matter of having, you know, for maybe my child who you know, comes from a relatively higher, you know, at least reasonable income family, with a lot of intangible resources, that child's going to do okay in any kind of system. But there are lots of children that are not, unless you have a fully integrated system that the schools cannot simply always provide themselves.
Thank you. Mr. Scherzinger, as Chalkboard is also looking at the QEM as far as not a funding mandate but a planning tool, you indicated that you're looking at other states, and as part of the comparisons that you'll be making as far as adequacy, stability, equity, transparency, efficiency.
Right.
Now, will you be making available in your work, or just the ultimate outcome, demographic similarities, states with the same type of demographics as Oregon, their student populations, their funding levels, and perhaps their successes?
I'm trying to recall if we specifically had, we have looked at some of that data, whether or not it's going to be in that final report. Certainly be in some of the supplemental materials, mm-hmm. because we'll have anything we do, I'm sure we'll be at the chalkboard, but I presume will be available. But we have looked at like neighboring states and that sort of thing. There'll be lots of stuff in there.
Thank you.
So
we'll wait for the report.
Yeah.
I did have one question, actually two, on the colleagues. In your work, you haven't ignored the existence of No Child Left Behind, but have you really taken it into consideration what it means?
Well, we're looking at funding, and so...
And it has a lot of implications for funding.
Right.
It does.
It has a lot of implications for sort of incentives. I'm not sure that there was funding that went with it, and we're counting that funding in our revenue base. But I'm not sure what I would say about, you know, that it actually affects the total amount of funding that we have, other than through the appropriation process.
But it might affect the need.
Oh, on what we need? Well, I guess my view of that is that NCLB is an imperfect expression of an accountability system for education. And that that doesn't mean that we don't have the same goals. That elimination of the achievement gap, that all kids get to standard. It's just their particular way of trying to implement an accountability system, and I think it has some strengths and weaknesses like all of the mechanisms that are out there in education today as a management system, and there are some significant weaknesses to it. But on the other hand, it's there's a lot of room for schools to improve, and it's been not only an incentive to do that in many states, and I would argue in Oregon, you know, we started earlier than most, but it's also been sort of a, I guess I don't know what the right word is, a rallying cry, I guess, amongst community groups, different ethnicity groups, to demand better results from the school system. And I think it's important, one important way to get results with each different group is to involve them in the process. And that there is a lot that each, that that groups that represent people of different cultures or different backgrounds can do to help teachers understand how to work with those types of students. And to get anything that sort of is an incentive to get them involved in the system, I think is in a positive way, is a good thing. And it has done that in many places. You can't deny that many urban school districts have improved in recent years. Now, I can't say that No Child Left Behind is a good accountability system for that, but a lot of improvement has happened, and it needs a lot of fixing, but like I say, to go back to not having any accountability, to me, isn't the way to go.
Another question. In terms of this thing about transparency, Representative Wisnant, who served on one of the committees during session two of the committees, had this concern, and I think it was legitimate, that we talk in the building in sort of a different language, and we talk about different numbers from what the real numbers are. For instance, all the discussion in this building here was over the difference between 5.0 and 5.4. That is not the total funding for K through 12. Just as is if in your new assignment, Mr. Scherzinger, $2.6 billion is not the total funding for human services. It's more like 9.5 or 9.6. You don't face a $172 million funding problem in human services. You actually face about a $380 or $390 million problem in terms of, a goodly portion of the federal funds. Do you think it causes problems in terms of the public understanding that we never use accurate language? We never let them know what the full ramifications are, what the full costs are.
I think the way we talk about these issues is a problem with the public. I'm not sure it's improved a whole lot by talking about 9 million instead of 5 million. I think unless you talk more in terms that, you put 5 billion in the paper or 9 billion in the paper, I think most people don't, it doesn't tell them any more one way or the other. I think you have to be more transparent about how the money is being spent. What does it cost to educate a child? How much are we spending on this type of child versus that type of child, and why are we doing that? What is the effect of changing that? It has to come down to practical, real terms to most people, and I don't know that it helps any to be saying $9 billion instead of $5 billion. Because there's no frame of reference. You have no way of comparing that to anything. I used to joke when I was here that, whenever there was a, I forgot the numbers now, but let's just say that 1% is $50 million. You know, whenever there was a $50 million shortfall, it was a 1% shortfall. Whenever there was a $50 million increase, it was a $50 million windfall. And people need, the numbers don't mean anything to people. They need a frame of reference. And And it's the frame of reference that's important to talk about to me in a
accurate way. Sometimes if we talked in more consistent numbers.
Well, that would certainly help, yes.
Well, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I could give you, you know, lots of examples where that would help.
Well, and actually the Open Book Project is an effort to try to use the same numbers, the same categories in our external communications with the public.
Right.
Any additional questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can we bring up Lori Wimmer Whalen and Mr. Sager? And maybe staff, well, they're back. And then we will go to the Oregon School Boards Association and to COSA.
Would you like to go first? Any questions?
Mr. Sager, why don't you go first?
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Devlin and members of the committee. For the record, I'm James Sager from the Governor's Office. And I guess what I'd like to do for just a few moments, if I could, is put the Governor's thinking around the quality education model in perspective to what the way he sees education, how he uses that. I'm sorry Representative Vakian had to step out, but the Governor does believe that the future of our economy is based on having a solid education program pre-kindergarten through adult learning. It's a lifelong learning process. And that it isn't a matter of either or, either skills training or citizenship training, but it is training people for their next step in life so that they're ready for the workforce, they're ready for advanced learning, they're ready for citizenship, and that is a package, and that's the way we have to look at it. The Governor, when he was a member of the Supreme Court, served on the Quality Education Commission, so he helped create this. He understands the value of connecting the cost drivers and the best practices that are needed in order to help move our students in K-12 to the standards that, as a state, that we have set. So he understands the value of it, and he uses it. Now, I'm going to digress for just a minute. I think it's difficult to compare that statement with the Governor's December 1st budget. Luckily, between December 1st and the end of the session, we came up with about $500 million more in resources after a 21% loss in our general fund over the previous biennium. And together, we put a significant amount of that extra money into the education system. But some examples of the way the Governor has used the model. It was mentioned earlier that the data system was one of the top recommendations, and the Governor recognized that and helped support that and, with your help, put that through the legislative process. Because if we're going to have an accountability system, if we're going to understand that the results we're getting from our investment, we need to have a system that not only works horizontally between schools and school districts and community colleges, but vertically, so that we can see what the results are down the road, and that information can feed back into the system so we can make good decisions. But it also helps solidify in the Governor's mind why we have to stop talking about our education system in this bifurcated manner, and that we have to take an enterprise view of this. That is, a very good example was a meeting I was at yesterday with one of the committees of the Higher Ed Board. Now, this committee, though, is made up of representatives from all the sectors, including private universities, community colleges, K-12, et cetera. And we were talking about aligning the curriculum, and the focus had been aligning the curriculum between community colleges and between community colleges and the universities, because we have 17 community colleges, 7 public universities, and a variety of privates, all having a different standard as to what they say indicates you're ready to take their writing class or you're ready for their next level of math. By standardizing that understanding at the post-secondary level, we can now turn around to our K-12 colleagues and say, if you get that 12th grader to this level, they're going to be able to enter any university, any community college in Oregon, and they're going to know where they fit into that system. And so we really have to talk about the value of working across these sectors so that we understand the value of the investment. Having a target for K-12 that doesn't match up with what the post-secondary system or the workforce training system requires of a candidate doesn't make a lot of sense. And so we have to have this broader view, and that's why the governor has asked members of the commission to be thinking broader than just the K-12. He has directed the joint boards of education to look at that alignment issue across the system. Another very good example is the remediation issue. If we look at the number of students in our community colleges taking remedial classes, people go, wow, that is way far too many. But then you have to start breaking it down and saying, well, wait a minute, is that student the 18-year-old who just last June left one of our high schools, or is it the 19, 20, 25, 30-year-old who is coming back into the education system? Most of us would probably have to take some remedial math to move into college-level math. I know I would. I haven't had a math class for several years. We know, and in talking to a number of the math professors in the university system, they say after about 6 months, you start losing the ability to think in the manner in which they need you to think when you're taking the classes. And so you begin to have the data that allows you to understand why the investment is necessary and what we're getting for that investment. And so having this kind of data, the kind of data that the Quality Education Commission, that the database initiative at K-12 has helped us to pull together, to be able to expand that kind of review, that kind of budget transparency, to be able to explain to Oregonians and to be able to have a conversation in the legislative process where we're really talking about the policy decision as to why we are going to invest our next dollar in a certain area because we feel here's the outcome we want and we're going to be able to get from that investment, becomes a very powerful tool. And that should really be the direction that we take. The conversation just a minute ago about the $5 billion or $8 billion, I agree with Jim totally that after so many zeros, your eyes start to glaze over. But if the average person can sit down and say, okay, we spend $3,000 for an undergraduate or lower division English class, and what does that get for us? Now you can start putting it into a level of relationship that the average individual can begin to have understanding around. And we, as the people that have to make those decisions, can then start discussing, okay, what are the pros and cons of certain kinds of investments? So so that is important, and that is why the governor wants this enterprise look, so that we can look at how we leverage those resources across the sectors. Imagine what, going back to my example of knowing what the standard, imagine to be able to go to students and parents and say, if your child takes this English class in their junior year in high school, it counts. You're not only going to get three college credits, but it counts as writing 121 at any university or community college. That has real meaning now, and people understand why we're investing money at that point, because students are ready for that kind of experience. And it doesn't have to take place at the university. It could take place in high school. And so it's that kind of conversation that that we think that these kinds of tools can lead us to. And I'll let you ask me questions.
We'll go to Ms. Wimmer first, and then we'll take questions. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, for your record. Lori Wimmer Whalen. I'm the Government Relations Consultant for the Oregon Education Association, representing 43,000 teachers, community college faculty, and classified workers. I wanted to thank you very much for considering at the perspective of the association as you work to develop your ballot measure one report subsequent to the 05 session. Our association, just for, by way of a little history, worked to promote passage of the law that created the ballot measure one requirement. And it passed voter muster, you may be interested to learn, in all 36 counties of Oregon and won statewide by more than a 2-to-1 margin. We also worked with the legislature to develop implementing legislation, I think it was House Bill 2295, in the 2001 session. As you know, the constitutional requirement of this law is to fund schools adequately using the calculations developed through the quality education model process. Within 6 months of the close of each session, the body is supposed to produce a report for the public consumption that indicates whether or not this funding goal has been achieved, and if not, to explain why not. Additionally, the report must describe the impacts reasonably to be expected from a level of funding that does fall short of that adequacy goal. In two prior biennia, your colleagues have issued the report, and in each case, funding has been deemed inadequate. In acknowledging this fact, the report has described the structural revenue issues, political environment, and cost drivers that explain the reason for the gap between the legislatively adopted budget and the quality education model goal. We've appreciated the thoughtful presentations and candor of both of those two reports, and they've provided a valuable public service. They break through the chatter and in some cases ease some confusion about school funding and the numbers, and you've had quite a fascinating discussion this morning about all those issues. We acknowledge that the current climate has made fully funding public education. I don't say fully fund the model. I say fully fund public education. The model is only to help inform you about what that number ought to be. We understand that that's impossible at this time. We do not see this report as a gotcha document, but rather as truth serum. While the ultimate level of funding required for 90% of Oregon's public school children to achieve standards is a goal beyond this body's current grasp, that doesn't make the goal itself somehow suspect, as some people do argue. Dennis Watley once said, "The reason most people never reach their goals is that they don't define them or ever seriously consider them as believable or achievable. Winners can tell you where they're going, what they plan to do along the way, and who will be sharing the adventure with them. Sharing the adventure of public education funding with you all, let me review the facts as we see them for the purposes of your report. One, the quality education model target for the state's share of full funding for 05-07 is $7.1 billion. Two, the Legislative Assembly enacted a K-12 budget that provides $5.24 billion plus an additional potential $23 million more in the second half of the biennium should certain economic indicators be in place to allow the escalator. Three, by our count, the state's share of the total school formula revenue pot could be said to be $5.263 billion in total. Four, additional local revenue, chiefly from the property tax and the common school fund, enhance this appropriation, but it is the state's share that is the relevant number for the purposes of the Ballot Measure 1 report. And finally, using these facts, the Ballot Measure 1 report should indicate that the state's 2005-07 K-12 appropriation falls short of adequate by $1.837 billion. Just briefly, I'd like to close by touching on an issue I know some of you have asked about, your tool for measuring school funding sufficiency, which is what I perceive the quality education to be, your tool. It is a tool for assessing costs for service delivery using best practices to Oregon students, and it's been recognized nationally for its accuracy and methodology by funding experts. I go to a lot of conferences around the country, and we're always held up as the way to do it right. The state of Oregon has invested heavily in its development and refinement of this model over the years. As a member of the most recent QEC cost panel, I've been impressed with the thorough and unblinking approach the model has used to determine the cost of meeting Oregon's educational goals. The implementing legislation I referred to, passed in 2001, allows the legislature to substitute another methodology, equally sound and research-based, for the QEM if you have the grounds or desire to do so. Like the QEM, however, that alternative methodology must, and I'm quoting from the enrolled bill now, be based on research, data, and public values and the performance of successful schools, professional judgment, or a combination of the performance of successful schools and professional judgment. Clearly, the legislative intent of this law is to use the QEM unless a better, more accurate model has been developed to supplant it. We fear that some may interpret this language to mean that if one doesn't like the number the QEM recommends, she or he may simply substitute a lesser standard that offers a lower calculation. OEA believes that the state's investment in our well-regarded, sound model is not one to cast aside lightly. We also question whether the time and money exist to reinvest in a different and equally research-based system of analysis by which to assess the 0507 appropriation and to do so in time to meet your February 1st deadline. We ask that you stick with the proven metric, and we look forward to your report. Thank you.
Questions? I'll start off this time. First with Mr. Sager. When the governor put forward his budget, a short time later, he provided what was referred to as a ballot measure one report, and I believe you crafted much of that report. You made quite a bit of use of the quality education model in describing what the impacts would be at that funding level. Could you comment on that, and can you provide copies of that report to Mr. Keller for the committee?
Senator Devlin, I'd be happy to provide copies of the report. I'll get one to you after the session today. We did use the quality education model because, in fact, that was the tool, again, that we had to look at to say, if this is the gap in funding, here are the potential impacts of those gaps. And so, again, trying to be very transparent and honest, we went to the model, we looked at what the impacts could be, and the governor said, this is the kind of information I want to share with the legislature and the public. You don't want to hide this stuff. I mean, it was the $5 billion level, the governor openly admitted, was not adequate. And, I mean, that was the bottom line, and then you have to say, well, what do you think the impact of that would be? And that's what we used. Now, like I said, when it came out, now we have a difference of agreement with OEA as to how we would define what the final number is. But with all the numbers and the extra local revenue, it's 5318, which the revenue committee had determined was kind of that essential budget level or continuing service level target. And so it became a target that I think a lot of us worked on, but we used the model because, in fact, it is a good tool, just as it is a good tool the other way around, to say, if now we were to determine that we had $100 million that we wanted to invest in the system, where would be the most strategic point to make that investment, and what outcome can we predict we would get from that investment? Now, the thing that we always have to keep in mind when we do that is that the kinds of outcomes that we're looking at in education is different than we could get maybe on the assembly line. If I change, you know, the way I put my bolt in and I tighten it up, the wheels won't fall off as often. But when I'm changing the way that I teach a first grader or an eighth grader a particular subject, and you do that repeatedly over several years, you're going to see the outcome, but you won't necessarily see the change 6 months or 2 years from now, which is why it's important that we have a broader term look at education to understand that, in fact, this is a progressive issue and it's something that we see develop over time. It's not an overnight sudden change in senior graduation rates or outcomes of community college students.
Second, one for Mr. Sager. In Governor Kitzhaber's budget, mm-hmm. The one for 2001, mm-hmm. biennium, there was about $200+ million put in, targeted under the QEM,
right.
to reading, particularly in early grades. It's kind of interesting that the first item that was cut in the special session in terms of education was the second $100 million of that. And that now we have a recommendation from the Quality Education Commission in this report to put money back into that area. We gave the incentive, we said we need to look at this area, we took the $100 million away in the second year of the biennium, said never mind, and now they put this forward for 2005-2007, we didn't fund it, and obviously it'll probably be back in an 07-09 recommendation. Can you comment on that?
Senator Devlin, I'd be happy to. Actually, first of all, I'd like to maybe clarify that investment at that point. What the agreement was that the school districts would reallocate $120 million and that the legislature would match that with the second $120 million. The match is what didn't occur. So the school districts did reallocate resources, and they asked their kindergarten through fifth grade teachers and support staff to focus on reading and math, and the target was to get, I forget if it was 80 or 90% of the students at both grades to reading and math standards. The education community responded, did what was asked. We didn't come through with the extra amount of money, but the change was made. And so that is why you have seen that at those levels, they have been able to sustain those kinds of results with students. Now, what is masked in that approach is what you all were talking about just a few minutes ago. It has been at the expense of what? It has been at the expense of physical education and art and music and other programs that we all know, whether we're educators or parents or just community members, are really vital and important to the well-being of children. I mean, this last session we had a number of discussions about obesity problems. It's hard to talk about obesity when we didn't provide the resources to provide the programs necessary to help, you know, kids have a have an active experience during their school day. So, I mean, those are the trade-offs that we have. The fact is we know that by having a good educational start, that, in fact, that gain helps students in future years. Just as we know by expanding early childhood education, we could help more students be ready for school, therefore have a leg up, thus be able to do better, and you begin to see the progression, the growth that takes place. The discussion that took place in before the 2001 session was that that would be the first incremental investment in the system, so that if we put that investment forward, the education community could demonstrate that, in fact, they could produce, then the next level of investment would come on, which might be, say, focused at middle school or wherever that next strategic investment should be. That's what we need to get back to, is that kind of conversation to say, here's our investment, here's the expectation we have from that investment. If the education community produces, we are ready to move to the next step and use the model as that kind of guide to make those kinds of policy decisions.
Ms. Wimmer, in House Bill 2295, I've got the right reference here. I wanted to touch again on the issue of looking at an alternative model. I've talked to some people, including yourself, that clearly it's not talking about, it's talking about if you were to do something different, that you had a completely developed alternative model that had the same type of resources put into its development as the quality education model. Now, that doesn't in any way limit the committee from commenting on issues like the commission commented on, that they will look at it in the future, but they did not have the resources to look at the full implications of No Child Left Behind, but they had considerable concerns about what resources might be necessary to meet that 99% achievement level. But I wanted you to reiterate that in terms of when it talks about an alternative, it talks about a fully developed model, doesn't it?
Right, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that is precisely the case. And those are, as I tried to say, an expensive undertaking to create your system and to fine-tune it. Gosh, we started way back when, not just with then-Representative Lundquist's original quality education package they put together, a commission, but then I remember his successor, Speaker Lynn Snodgrass, created the Education Leadership Team and had an education summit and brought a lot of people together from all over. It was a huge undertaking, an incredible event, as a matter of fact. It was very exciting to be a part of it. And a lot of the best thinking, and people from outside the state came to that as well, a lot of the best thinking came to the table and developed the consensus that ultimately resulted in the early reading initiative that Mr. Sager just mentioned in the first school improvement fund as an elemental step. It was sort of the consensus of all parties on deck
that would be an important first place. If you only had a small pot of additional resources to deploy, where would you start? But understanding that, it isn't that there aren't other ways to develop calculations of how to make those numbers real and based on meaningful estimations of what it takes to achieve a quality education. It just means that whatever it is you've invested in and moved forward with, it would be a shame, as long as it is a substantive and working process, to just throw it out in favor of something else because you don't like the number it reports, especially given that, with all due respect, the budget for the Quality Education Commission, which is charged with refining the work each biennium, has been cut, I believe, somewhere in the neighborhood of 75% from its original operating funds. We can't keep adding more stuff for them to do with fewer and fewer hands on deck to do that work.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. First, I wanted to ask a question of you. Now, you made reference to the governor and the budget release. Are you talking about his most recent one?
Yes. There was a statement actually released after the budget, which was kind of called a ballot measure one statement.
Okay, because I had the 0103, I guess, or 03 or 04, and I didn't have that current one, so I would be interested in seeing that. Excuse me, but I wanted to express some concern, Ms. Wimmer-Wayland, when we, and Mr. Sager, when we're talking about ballot measure one, it was approved, yes, you are correct, significantly by a vote of the people in November of 2000. And I think that even Mr. Sager's statement that this will help people see how money is being spent, and to kind of synopsize your statement in the ballot measure statements there. Transparency, I think, is what was the driving force for that particular overwhelming passage of the ballot measure one. But it was subsequent to that then, in 2001 legislature, that legislation was passed and created the QEC, the QEM. So are we not trying to affirm a negative when the quality education model comes out significantly higher than we can begin to possibly get to, and we're to say that it's absolutely right, we can't get there, rather than to have a more positive discussion and say the resources that we have are being utilized in a sense to, we are closing the achievement gap, we are bringing students to standard, and to have that dialogue rather than to affirm the negative that we will probably never be able to get to if we do include everything that should be in the best case scenario.
Mr. Chair and Representative Flores, I'll be happy to take that. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think all of those conversations need to happen in as clear and understandable a way as possible. And I think that the problem lies in the definition of sufficiency or adequacy. And I think that the Quality Education Project, which actually I think in some form predated the ballot measure, but ultimately was created through the commission's work after that, was in response to what I saw as a very widespread and bipartisan in this building desire to make the number less political and more linked to meaningful measures. And I think having a yardstick is always a useful thing because you have to know where you're going in order to get there.
Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Flores, let me expand just a little bit. I do think that if my memory serves me right, the timing was a little different in that the development of the model had been ongoing prior to the ballot initiative, which said, in fact, you have to use this model against our standards to put out a report. So the model was being created, had not been fine-tuned as much as it has today. But, in fact, it was in the process, and so they were kind of happening at the same time. But your point about the negative, you made a very good point, and I think part of it has to do with the timing of the recession. We passed ballot measure one and said you have to start using this model now and reporting, and except for the first effort, which was the 2001 session where we had very good intentions of beginning this process of, in a positive way, saying, here's our movement towards it. When you lose $3 billion, you're going to be talking about negatives because you're going to be talking about cuts. Now is an opportunity that we have because, in fact, we are growing our way out of the recession to once again look at the tool from the basis of the model, which is, and I'm sorry I keep repeating myself, but we can use this model now to say, here would be the next good investments. And by not just focusing on K-12, but again, looking at the entire enterprise, we can start talking about the relationships between those investments and the impact on community colleges and the university and how they can play a role in the investment we make at K-12 or how they benefit from the investment at community college, et cetera. So I think we have an opportunity now to turn the conversation around and begin to put forward the positive message to Oregonians. We have an amazing commitment on the part of Oregonians, whether it's teachers or parents and others who have kept this system going and have done remarkable work with students. And now we have an opportunity to begin to very strategically invest and help them do an even better job.
Quick follow-up. Thank you. I don't disagree that the model was in process, but as the campaign for ballot measure one was moving forward and in the summary statement and in the voters pamphlet statement, there was not reference to the Quality Education Commission or the Quality Education Model. There was reference to our statutory requirement to pursue quality education as pursuant to the quality education goals defined in statute. Quality education goals being set by not only the state board but the Department of Education. So I think that the public was responding not specifically, as you just indicated, to the model, because it wasn't referenced in here. Mm-hmm. It was responding to providing good education for our kids, mm-hmm. as you're required to do. And I think that debate that we carry on today was part of that response. And that's a rhetorical, I guess, does not require a comment. Sure. Thank you.
My memory is getting short, but I think it was Representative Morgan, and then I can't remember who and Representative Bach yet.
And if you look on this side,
having worked with this report, this being the third time, kind of good example of recycling, I guess, I have to confess to some frustration with it. I find that with the leaving aside a discussion about the value of the quality education model in defining an acceptable level of education, from a pragmatic point of view, I don't see how we are ever going to get to a different report than the two that have already been released. The differential between what we have the ability to put into K-12 and what the model says is needed is always going to be a big difference. And just for example, the first time that we did this report, we fell into one of the worst recessions that Oregon's ever seen. We lost more than 20% of the revenue. If you take a look at the whole spectrum of education services that the state provides, you're looking at more than 60 cents out of every dollar that the state spends. It isn't possible to make, or it wasn't possible, it would never be possible, to make the kind of economies that we had to make to balance the size of the budgets with the revenue without making cuts in the education arena. And we did that. I mean, we all made those very difficult decisions and bit the bullet and made the cuts not only in education, but in every policy area, in every service area that the state funds. So right there, we're in a position where we've widened the gap. The number in the model is going to continue to go up. If the good Lord's willing, the revenue numbers for the state are going to continue to go up. They probably aren't on the same slope, but the probability of the funding number crossing the QEM number, I think, is not there, and it never will be there. And so we're going to be, when we come back here in the next session, in the very same position that we've always been in, where there is no way from a practical political perspective that we'll be able to get anywhere near the number that the Quality Aid Commission puts out there. We have to look at all of the services that the state funds, and we have to find a balance there that's politically possible to attain and that from a moral and a humanitarian perspective is a proper balance to attain too. So we also need to learn from what we went through in 0103. We established the Education Stability Fund, which was probably, I think, over time going to be looked at as the most positive thing that we did for the state of Oregon. We hugely need to put in a rainy day fund for the rest of the programs besides education and help augment that. And so when we come back next time, that needs to be part of the consideration of the balance of funding. We also have a huge pent-up demand in all of the other policy areas and service areas that we fund because those budgets are all also wanting to recover back to the level that they were at before. And with the increasing populations, there's all those internal stresses there too. So the probability that we're going to be able to make substantial increases in an investment in the education arena is probably not that great. There probably is a much greater probability that we'll be able to make incremental increases in investments, but we'll make them across all of the policy areas. So it becomes, I think, really incumbent at this point, not just in the education arena, but in all the arenas of funding, to continue to be looking for efficiencies in service delivery. And it's great to hear the governor's staff continue to be pushing the more, better, faster concept, because I think that it's through those kinds of things, through breaking down the barriers between the last years of high school and the community colleges and the first 2 years of the four-year system, and moving those students through there more quickly and more efficiently, that we're going to achieve savings. And then we're going to be able to apply those savings in other parts of the system. So I really have a great deal of frustration about the pointlessness of talking about the inadequacy of funding, because I think that we're going to be much better off to try to put in place some cushions for the next time we have to go through this so that we can cut the bottoms off of the trough a little bit, and how we can redefine the delivery systems so that we're making better use of the funding that we do have to work with. And I'll get off my soapbox.
Mr. Chair, can I respond to that just briefly? Representative Morgan, I couldn't agree with you more with everything you just said. Or virtually everything you said. My hope springs eternal that we'll get closer and close that gap to some degree over time. But I think that is precisely what the value of the Ballot Measure 1 report is to say, to offer that analysis and that backdrop and that conflicting priorities and all the things that you all are faced with in that report, so that the public has the kind of clarity about those tough budget decisions and the revenue situation that you confront when you come down here to represent them. I don't think that they get that in that kind of a comprehensive way that you just lined out. And I'd love to see that in the report.
Chair Devlin?
Yes.
Could I expand? Thank you. Representative Morgan, I too would agree, and I know that the governor agrees with that frustration too, because we have expectations out there of 100% of the QEM, full health care for, you know, every Oregonian, on and on and on. And our revenue structure in this state, our population base in this state, cannot generate the revenue that it takes to fund all of those desires that we have. And so that's why the governor and you as a legislature have been working with this too, begun to set out real priorities to say, no, here's how we're going to spend the money. We have to make these tough decisions. And so, and again, this gets back to the transparency. The more clear we are with Oregonians that, you know, here's the dollar we have, and this is all we can buy with it,
that. You know, that's it. And here are the set of priorities we used to make that determination that that was how we were going to spend that dollar. At least it becomes in a discussion about the policy decision, not always this impression that, well, there's always enough money. If there is enough money, then we'd be doing it. I don't think anyone here is morally driven by this. By golly, we're not going to give, you know, what children or adults want in the state. We're all morally driven by wanting to provide those services. So we need to have that transparency. This report, I think, has become very negative because we have always looked at it as, doesn't matter what we do, we fail because we can't get to 7.2 tomorrow. I would hope that collectively we could begin to turn the report around and again be a positive message to Oregonians and ourselves to say, this is our target. It's not that we're failing. This is our target. Someday, down there, this is where we'd like to be. But our next step is this investment. And quit using the report, whether it's the governor's report or the legislator's report, as a hammer against each other saying, see, by God, you're not doing the right thing. But really talk about priorities, how we're using the money, being clear with Oregonians, because only then can we as Oregonians have a discussion about are our wants, our expectations, do they exceed our willingness to pay? And if they do, we're going to have to make an adjustment on one or the other or both to bring them in line. We can't have that discussion today if people assume there's enough to buy everything, and we're sitting here saying we know the reality of the limits of our revenue. We have to bring those in line.
Well, I need to make one comment, and I do agree with you, Jim, but I think that we need to be very clear that as our ability to make investments increases, the number that the quality education model is coming up with is also going to increase, and I have no hope that we'll ever close that gap.
I understand completely.
At this particular juncture, we only have about 15 to 20 minutes left before we go to lunch. I know that Ms. Wimmer can be back this afternoon. If we need you, can we get a hold of you this afternoon, Mr. Senator?
We'll be upstairs with the governor, so you can call me on my cell phone. I'll give it to Jim, and he can buzz up to me.
Well, with that, thank you very much for your testimony.
Okay.
And I'm going to bring all three people remaining. Oh, you had questions?
Oh, I see. We're going to bring him back this afternoon so I can ask my question. Thank you. I have serious questions.
Yeah. We're just running out of time is what's happening.
Not that any of the questions we've heard today aren't serious, but we have some serious questions.
I'm going to bring all three people up. Mr. Buckstein, why don't you come up? Mr. Marshall and Mr. Bennett. And Mr. Marshall and Mr. Bennett, I'm not calling you up last because it's personal in any sense. I can show you the agenda I was given, and you were last on the agenda. That's because you do very well at cleanup.
I think he wants to save the lot.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. Good morning. It's been a fascinating discussion this morning, and I'm not sure that I can add too much. But in response to the direct question you posed, what should be in the ballot measure one statement, it seems to me that we certainly have to recognize that K-12 funding is inextricably linked to Oregon's economy and its ability to produce revenue, period. Now, we can argue about the tax system and the extent to which it taps into the revenue produced by our economy, and I'm sure that argument will continue. But the fundamental point is that school funding will improve when Oregon's economy improves. The fundamental question you're struggling with is one of whether the current level of investment that we're making in our public education system matches the expected return on that investment. And the problem with that discussion is that, if I could use an analogy, if you're 50 years old and you want to retire in 15 years, and you want 60% of your current income for your lifetime after you retire at age 65. You go to a financial advisor, and they will tell you, this is your income now based on market return. If you want that level of income based on your lifespan, here's how much you have to invest. So the amount that you invest is quantifiable, and the amount of the expected return that you want is quantifiable. Well, what we're trying to do in answering the question, is the investment we're making in our public education system matching the return on that investment? We know about the investment. We know how much we contribute to the public education system. We know how much the system spends. We know how much the system has to spend. The problem is quantifying the expected return. Now, the Quality Education Commission has decided that their expected return is how much does it cost to get 90% of our students to the standard. And it seems to me that the quantifying that question is extremely difficult. Maybe the question ought to be how much does it cost to create the infrastructure to assure that every student has an opportunity to meet those standards. So I think there seems to me to be a disconnect between what we want to invest and the return on that investment. But unfortunately, we don't have any other options. If we talk about the quality goals established by law, which the Constitution directs us to deal with, the only quality goal we have, it seems to me, is how well our students are doing relative to the standards we set. And so it would seem to me then the return has to be how well our students do against the measurement that we've created for them. Quality means more students reach those standards. I think that the problem, obviously, is quantifiability. So with that, most of my career in this building has been spent arguing that whatever level of appropriation the legislature ultimately comes up with is not enough. And your challenge is trying to define what is enough. And we're certainly willing to work with you, but I recognize the challenge. And it's interesting, finally, to note that in both the 01-03 Ballot Measure 1 report and the 03-05 Ballot Measure 1 report, in response to the question, is the investment we're making in our public education system matching the expected return, the answer is no. And the reasons given was that inextricable link to Oregon's economy and its inability to produce the revenue that gives the legislature the ability to fund schools, to fund public safety, to fund human services that matches the expected return for all those segments. So with that, I'll be glad to respond to any questions. Oh.
Mr. Buckstein, can you stay another 10 minutes?
Sure.
Actually, okay. Mr. Bennett, so that I kind of have some continuity.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and Madam Co-Chair, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Just in the interest of time, a couple of fairly random thoughts, I think, dealing with a couple of the issues that have been raised. First, COSA fundamentally agrees with all of the remarks that have been presented to you this morning in terms of the value, the usefulness, the importance, the vision of the quality education model and the work done by the Quality Education Commission, and want to assure you that its application at the local level is both regular and important as administrators and I believe school boards as well deal with capital and operational planning over the next or over 10 and 20 year periods. It's a vital part of it. The question you asked us, though, I think was what are our comments specifically regarding the report and what it looks like. We have not been in any way unhappy with the existing reports that have come out over the past couple of biennia. We'd ask you to follow the same format. We think it's informative. The numbers need to change. We happen to agree with, as you heard the debate, I think, between the governor's office and Ms. Wimmer-Whalen on the what's the number to plug in on what the legislature spent. We happen to agree with OEA's number, not with the governor's office number. That's your decision as to what you think you spent on K-12. One area, though, that the legislature is uniquely qualified to make comment and perhaps even to make some qualitative comment is on legislative revenue decisions. And we would ask you in that area in the past, it's been a little thin. And it would seem like, given the quality of debate that's occurred around our tax system, our tax expenditures, and the variety of other issues associated with that, that this area certainly deserves discussion. Now, whether you can get into certain parts of it, I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether you can or you can't, or discussions of the current revenue system and the attendant impact it has on the availability of funds to fully fund the quality education model. The existing revenue system can't do it, and certainly legislative decisions associated with that would at least be worth you taking, I hope, a more in-depth self-evaluation and critical look at your own role and why it exists the way it does today. Beyond that, we are part of the same lobbying cadre that faces exactly what Representative Morgan described, which is we come in, we're looking also at a balanced budget, and balanced, I don't mean in terms of dollars and cents. I mean just in the balancing act that you go through in meeting all the needs of the state. If human resources is underfunded, we're affected. If public safety is underfunded, we're affected. And so each of those areas become extremely important to us. And I think as a result, we participate in a discussion around real numbers. We rarely talk about the quality education model number as somehow the target number. I think we all come in with realistic expectations. I think the time the quality education model number comes up and is really discussed is as we approach 2014 and have to meet these targeted standards, whether it's NCLB's 99% or the Oregon standard of 90% of children meeting these testing requirements, we're getting close. And I think the more candid you are as you deal with this issue, the more likely your successors dealing with next biennium, the biennium after, and I think we're only, what, three or four biennia away from the cliff. And we're going to drop off it. You are not meeting those standards. We are not meeting those standards. And ultimately, we believe the bottom line is funding. And I want to assure you, because I think it comes up and will be discussed, I think probably even in the elections, your local school districts are spending these dollars absolutely as efficiently as they possibly can. And you all can rearrange the deck chairs, but you're not going to resolve it in Salem, what's going on in Pendleton. You just can't do it, or in Roseburg or anywhere else. You're still going to have to rely on those local decision makers. And I just can't assure you enough that those folks are doing absolutely the very best with the dollars that you're giving them to meet the needs and to achieve the challenge that's facing them. And it is a huge challenge with No Child Left Behind. Finally, I think part of what will make that more apparent is the Sue Hildick's and the Chalkboard Project's open book program. I hope you will visit that next week when that turns on, that website. It is going to be an amazing tool for you, for us, and especially for the public, which just clearly is having, as we have problems going through this and understanding it, they're having, I'm sure, an increasing difficulty trying to figure out what is going on with this school funding issue. And hopefully this will be a real tool for all of us to arrive at some common points of discussion. Thank you.
Okay, we'll go to Mr. Buckstein, then we'll go to questions. Mr. Buckstein, would you identify yourself?
Thank you. My name is Steve Buckstein. I'm a founder and now senior policy analyst at Cascade Policy Institute in Portland. And I'm glad you did take them in this order because I'm the contrarian so far this morning. And before I start my prepared remarks, Chairman Devlin, I just want to, in case it doesn't get out, your question about are we talking about the real numbers, I think is very important. And I was a little disappointed with Jim Scherzinger's answer that the public doesn't see can't relate to $5 billion versus $9 billion. But you do it per student, as Mr. Sager said, you know, in an English class, 3,000. When you look at what you allocate now per student at the state level, say $5,000 roughly per student, people can get their hands around that. And they don't have an idea that the real spending is closer to $9,000 or $10,000 or whatever it is. Those are real numbers that people can relate to, and I wish that from this building and the press and elsewhere, we'd be talking about those total numbers and not just what the state provides. Because you ask the man on the street, and if they're reading the paper, they might say, well, it's costing $5,000 per student, because that's what they hear coming out of this building. But in terms of your charge here, in terms of the ballot measure one, I want to be clear that I was not a supporter of ballot measure one, primarily because I didn't believe then and I don't believe now that the quality education model is a good benchmark for either funding or for educational achievement. I think it's a flawed model. Cascade published a report by an expert on these kind of issues, Dr. Richard Vedder out of Ohio University, back in 2000, after the QEM, the initial QEM was finalized. And I think you've got copies, or it's on our website, and I've distributed copies of a two-page summary of that report outlining the criticisms of the model. And the big criticism really is that the model, I believe, ignores an immense body of literature which questions the relationship between funding and academic results. The QEM calls for limits on class size, for example, at all grades, without acknowledging that such limits are very expensive and haven't been shown to have any positive effect on student achievement, except perhaps in the lowest grades, like K through 3. The QEM also tries to standardize other inputs, such as prescribing one guidance counselor per 250 students, even though there isn't any research to back up such a specific goal. Standardization, which I think is what the QEM is trying to do, is really a top-down governance structure, and in this case, it's Salem dictating to districts, schools, and teachers how they should do their jobs. The QEM also ignores what I believe is a whirlwind of efforts nationwide to change how educational services are delivered, as has been discussed here to some degree. Arguing for prototype schools, as the QEM does, again, seems to aim towards standardization at a time when consumers and students, parents and students, are demanding many more choices in their educational options, not less choices. Not everything in the QEM is bad from our standpoint. It does call for smaller schools, for example, and there does seem to be a good body of literature that indicates that smaller schools are helpful towards educational achievement, but not smaller classes as such. And of course, the ultimate standard, the ultimate goal of the QEM, at least when it was initially crafted, is that it would bring 90% of Oregon students to the statewide Certificate of Initial Mastery Standards. That was the actual language. But Superintendent Castillo all but declared SIM dead last month. So what's the goal of the QEM now? The superintendent said that she wants to replace SIM and CAM, Certificate of Advanced Mastery, with new tests that are somehow less political, as was quoted by, I think, one of her staff members in the Oregonian, somehow less political. But I think that's very hard to do since virtually everything in today's public education system, from funding to instruction, is steeped in politics. That's why we're here today. It's politics. And if the SIM can die at the hands of one of its most influential political supporters, what's to say that the QEM won't die sometime in the next few years when one of its most influential political supporters declares it dead, says that it really didn't do what we thought it should do? Even if the QEM proposals were grounded in solid academic research, education funding in Oregon, and I think probably every other state, doesn't necessarily end up where you as legislators would like it to end up. There are powerful special interests, some of whom you've heard from this morning, standing, in my view, between the kids and the money, between the kids and the funding. And their understandable goal, and it is understandable from a human standpoint, is to capture as much of that additional revenue as they can for their own members. And I won't go into a lot of detail about that at this point. So what should you do? You're charged with writing this report under ballot measure one. What I would suggest you do is tell Oregonians that the legislature didn't fund education to the QEM level because there was no rational basis to do so. There was no evidence that tacking, in this case, $1 billion or so onto the money that you already allocated would really achieve the goals that you're trying to achieve, or that Oregonians are trying to achieve. And there's no evidence that taking that $1 billion from other programs, the limited resources, or adding to the tax burden of the families, the parents of the students in the state, $1 billion, would have done anything to improve education. In fact, I think cutting those other programs to find the billion or burdening their parents with more taxes might very well have hurt the very educational goals that you're trying to achieve. Instead, I think what this committee should look at doing, instead of looking for another model, and you can do that at some point, but until you find some universal model that gives you the answers you think the QEM gives, I don't think there is such a model, but until you find one, I would pick a different goal. And just as an example, I would say, let's say that your goal was to spend 400% more, four times more in real terms per student than you were spending when I started school here in Oregon in the 1950s. Four times more in real inflation-adjusted terms. Coincidentally, that's what you're spending right now. You're spending four times more, approximately, in real terms per student, inflation-adjusted, than when I started school in the 1950s. And again, we've heard about all the reasons why it costs more to educate kids. But four times more is probably a good number to start with, and that's where you're starting. But after that, don't spend the money the way you've been spending it, allocated from the top down. Let's spend it the way that holds the adults in the system accountable, not just the kids. Today, I think we've talked a lot about accountability, or you've heard about it, but it's really the kids that are accountable. That's what all the tests are about. Test, test, test. So it's MCAM, third grade, fifth grade, eighth grade, a lot of tests, many of them not standardized tests that you can compare to other states, but there's a lot of testing going on. And when the kids fail, the adults simply ask for more money. I think that's what's happening here. The kids that aren't achieving the standards, the answer seems to be in this room and in this building, well, how much more money do we have to spend to get them to reach those goals? I think what you need to look at instead is how the American higher education system, not just Oregon, but our higher education system is seen as the envy of the world. It is achieving its goals, public and private combined. And the difference between our higher education system, one fundamental difference, and K-12, is that the customers get to choose where they get that education. They take the money with them. They either spend their own, or they're spending, you know, scholarship money or whatever. But there's a lot of choices in where they go for higher education. There's not a lot of standardization. I would disagree with, again, Mr. Sager on that. Standardizing every college in Oregon as far as what students need to do is the wrong approach. You need to have more choices, not fewer, and let consumers, let the parents and the students, when you come back to K-12, find the better answers for you. They will find them for themselves because they're more, frankly, it's more important to them than it is to us or than it is to you to find those right answers for their kids. And if they have more choices in K-12, I think they'll find them for themselves, and they'll also find them for you. You'll be able to see who's doing a good job and who's doing a bad job if you let the consumers allocate the money instead of letting the system, you know, the administrators and the legislators in this building do that. So I think we need to let the consumers vote with their feet and their dollars. Even if you're providing the dollars, don't think of them as going to districts. Think of them as going to students and giving many more, or allowing many more choices. And that would be my recommendation for what this committee should report under the ballot measure 1 requirements. Thank you.
Thank you. We have time for a few more questions, and then we will break for lunch. One thing, Mr. Marshall, we had this discussion earlier, and I'm not going to try to get you into a point-counterpoint sort of discussion. But if I had Senator Westland here and I had Senator Schrader here, they would probably want to debate revenue reform for the state. If I do have Senator Walker here, and I do have Representative Flores here, and Senator Starr, and Senator Deckert's not here, but I could probably put them in the room and they could debate what the future of SIMS should be. I know the superintendent has discussed that she believes it should go away, but it's actually still in statute, and that will actually be a discussion for the next legislative session. We had this discussion, Mr. Marshall, and I just wanted you to reiterate that, and I think a number of the other parties. This committee has a charge under law, and what we have is a responsibility to follow the law as it is now, not how we would like it to be, if you could comment.
Well, certainly, Mr. Chairman, as you directed some of us before as the committee got started, what should be in the ballot measure 1 statement, and I think that's the role and the responsibility of this committee. while there are options for other models, as has been suggested, to dump the model we've got and totally replace it, I think would be very, very expensive and very, very time consuming. So we've got a model. The statute requires you to refer to that model in terms of answering the question, was the appropriation sufficient or insufficient to meet the quality goals? And if it was, why was it? And if it wasn't, why wasn't it? So it seems to me that the question that you're asked to respond to is relatively simple.
I do have one request from my co-chair, actually. I had accidentally cut off Senator Walker, who had some questions for Ms. Wimmer and asked her for Mr. Sager. In the afternoon, could we bring them back for a time specific so she could answer those questions? Or ask those questions?
Well, at their convenience, if you want to start immediately after
we resume. Yeah, if we can get Mr. Sager back down here, then we'll do it right at 1:40.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mr. Co-Chair, I did send a note down to Mr. Keller seeing if we could get the governor's ballot measure 1 report to us by the time we get back from lunch, so we have a little bit of time to review that and perhaps ask Mr. Sager some questions about it, so we might not want him right at 1:30.
Okay.
But
do you have questions for Ms. Wimmer?
No, my questions were directed at Mr. Sager.
Okay. Any additional questions for people that are here at the desk line? With none, we will recess until 1:40.